Hi, this is Austin Hill. Hey, thanks for checking out this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. Now, you can hear our program live weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central Time. There are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows. They're available online. Our web address, of course, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning, 6:04. Welcome to it. It's the Faith Radio Network, where we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful as you get your day started, and as we all seek to connect faith to life. I'm Austin Hill, here weekday morning, 6 till 8. We appreciate you listening. We appreciate your support of Faith Radio. You can always find us at myfaithradio.com. Coming up later this morning, we revisit an issue that it's controversial in the minds of some. Fortunately, it's becoming more normalized, at least speaking about it and addressing it thoughtfully is becoming more normalized. A gentleman named Craig Gross, Pastor Craig Gross from Pasadena, California. He's an author and a speaker and a member of the clergy, as I said. He turned the evangelical community in America upside down some 12 years ago or so when he launched a website called XXXChurch.com. That's XXXChurch.com. That was a website responding to problems with pornography consumption and pornography addiction, even within the walls of the church. It was shocking back then that some people had those difficulties, and pornography was permeating and had become so pervasive that, yes, it was even impacting Christians in America. He's since written about the issue. He has a book out called Open, What Happens When You Get Real, Get Honest, and Get Accountable. And Craig Gross will join us coming up into the second hour of this episode to talk about what exactly does happen when an individual wants such accountability and such candor and transparency. It's not always easy to find other people with whom you can be candid and transparent, but Pastor Craig Gross has some suggestions on that. So that's forthcoming. Also, what happens to those among us? Perhaps it's you. Maybe it's members of your family. Perhaps people in your church. If you work in church ministry, if you're a clergy, a member of the clergy, a pastor, or even if you work on a level of laity, you work in lay ministry, and you know people who are relying on the federal taxpayer-funded subsidies through the Federal Affordable Care Act or the Obamacare program, people are relying on those government subsidies to purchase health insurance. Whether or not you'll receive the subsidies, whether or not those individuals will even be able to purchase insurance on the various Obamacare insurance exchange websites, that remains a big mystery. Coming up in just a little less than half an hour from now, a gentleman who's an economist and understands public policy very well, his name is Clark Judge. He will join us to sort of lay out what exactly the implications are of these two federal court rulings that were handed down about 24 hours ago, one of which said, you know, all this subsidy stuff, this is unconstitutional the way it's been constructed, so it needs to stop. And then, like, later in the same day, another federal court saying, no, we don't agree with that other federal court ruling. The subsidies can carry on. Most analysis says that the Obamacare agenda and the implementation of the system is compromised, and there's just uncertainty surrounding it. Nobody really knows what will happen. But at the end of the day, we're talking about real human beings, people like you, like me, who are relying on this government program, this newly created government program, to receive essential care for themselves and their families. So knowing what's ahead, whether we like it or not, and being able to face the future in an informed sort of way, that would seem pretty essential. So Clark Judge, an economist and analyst, he'll weigh in on that coming up at about 6:35 this morning. I want to talk about consistency. Consistency is a good thing. My colleagues in the other room, consistency is a good thing, right? Okay. Generally speaking, I guess if you're consistently wrong, that's not such a good thing. But if you're doing the right thing, you want to be consistent with it, right? When we come back, I'm going to tell you about a gentleman who is consistently been doing a particular thing. Well, this is nice and big. This is nice and ambiguous as we go into a break. A gentleman who is now 86 years old, and has consistently been doing the same thing since 1946. He lives in the Fargo-Moorhead region, and I'll tell you about this when we come back. I'm a big advocate for local small businesses. If you've ever heard my program here on the Faith Radio Network, Austin Hill's Big World of Small Business, this is really good news for the cause of being consistently good and supporting small businesses. And it's fun, and it comes from the Fargo-Moorhead region. I'll tell you about it when we come back. This is the Austin Hill in the Morning program. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. It's 6:09. Good morning. It's 6:10. It's the Faith Radio Network, where we connect faith to life. You can find us all the time at our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com. Myfaithradio.com. Coming up at just about a little more than 20 minutes from now, what exactly do the shakeups and court rulings with Obamacare and federal insurance subsidies mean for people in need of health care and health care coverage? We'll talk about that coming up in just moments. Now, I host a program I have for, well, gosh, the program has been going on for almost 4 years now, actually, but it's been a part of the weekend programming lineup here at the Faith Radio Network for, I guess, what we're into our second year now. It's called Austin Hill's Big World of Small Business. And that's where we talk about entrepreneurship and business ownership and the various ways in which people make a living even when they can't find a job. Now, that may sound kind of contradictory and counterintuitive, I suppose, to suggest that sometimes people make a living even when they can't find a job. But it's really true. There's freelance work that you can do. That's not if you're working as a freelancer. And by the way, I encourage pastors and church youth leaders to be speaking about and instructing young people in churches in the ways of entrepreneurship and even freelance work. If you work as a freelancer, you're by designation, you're working as an independent contractor. You're not somebody's employee. If I just perform a particular task for you, you need something built, you need a document created, you need me to run an errand for you, and we agree that you'll pay me X number of dollars in exchange for my services, well, that's independent contract labor. That's not employment. And that's something that we explore quite a bit on the program, Austin Hill's Big World of Small Business. But that said, it is also my conviction, well, a couple of things. I kind of reason it this way. For one thing, the United States economy, as is the case for really a good bit of the world, but the United States economy is absolutely reliant on the success, the successful, profitable operation of local small businesses. The vast majority of us who are blessed to have employment, we work for organizations and companies that are by designation small businesses. You know, at the time of my birth, that wasn't the case so much in the United States. Go back half a century. Have I really been around that long? And you go back 50 years, and the bulk of employment in the United States came from big government agencies and large corporations. That's not the case anymore. And we've also seen local small businesses and small business owners struggling for a whole variety of reasons over the course of the last 6 or 7 years or so. And so I believe that there are theological and biblical implications, theological and biblical underpinnings for the way we ought to be understanding labor and work and using our talents and investing ourselves and developing our skills and capacities and so forth. I believe the scriptures have a whole lot to say about that. And I think the scriptures have a whole lot to say about business and enterprise, things that a lot of us don't even really think about so much. We can be well-versed with the Bible. We may have read it several times, but if you're not looking for the economic and business wisdom in the Bible, it's, I suppose, easy to miss it. I missed it for a number of years myself. That said, that's kind of part and parcel to some of the things that we address on Austin Hill's Big World of Small Business, which is broadcast real-time on the Faith Radio Network, noon to 1 p.m. Central Time on Saturdays. But with all that having been said, let me turn the page here. This is really big stuff in terms of the well-being of local small businesses. And imagine being the small business owner in this story. Let me read to you just a little bit here. How are we doing on time here, Aaron? Are we okay? We got another 3 or 4 minutes? Okay, I got the thumbs up. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. All right. This is Dateline Fargo. In 1946, Harry Truman was president of the United States. Ted Williams was the American League's most valuable player. And Goodwin Hoff was a college kid in need of a haircut, period. A haircut, that should create images of a barbershop in your mind, okay? Let me read on. A Fargo native attending Concordia College at the time in Moorhead, Hoff heard that his friend's father owned a barbershop in the Graver Building in downtown Fargo, and he figured, why not go there to get a trim? That haircut, here's the good news, that haircut turned into a ritual, one that has been performed every 3 weeks or so in the same barbershop for the past 68 years. Hoff's only lapse in patronizing the local barbershop was the 2 years he served in the Korean War and received a buzz cut from an army officer. Quote, I didn't have much choice as to how they did it back then, so I took what they gave me, Hoff said dryly, as he celebrated his 68th year going to, on a every 3 week cycle, the Graver Barbershop. That is consistency, right? They actually had a nice little celebration there as he went in for marking 68 years of patronizing the same barbershop. By the way, as far as I can tell from the news reports, the barbershop is still owned by the same family there in Fargo as it has been for almost 70 years now. That stability, that's something that we ought not take for granted. Congratulations to you, Mr. Hoff, for being so consistent. And by the way, congratulations to the family that owns the Graver Barbershop. That is a very, very cool deal. It's 6:16. I'm Austin Hill. This is the Faith Radio Network. We're here weekday morning, 6 till 8. Our program continues consistently in moments. Don't go away. Good morning, and thank you for being here. It's the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill, and we appreciate you listening. We appreciate your support of the Faith Radio Network. Find us all the time at myfaithradio.com. What happens when Christians, individuals, really want to get candid and honest and transparent about their not-so-flattering areas of their lives? What happens to me, to you, when we seek to do that in the context of a church? Coming up in the 7 o'clock hour, we'll talk to Pastor Craig Gross, who's written a book and published a website on that matter. We like to say that the church is a hospital for sinners, right? But sometimes it's more difficult than not to actually find an environment where healing can begin. We'll talk with Pastor Craig Gross about that in the 7 o'clock hour. Also, Kim Cotola, who hosts her own program, Cradle My Heart, on the weekends here on the Faith Radio Network. She joins us later this morning to talk about what's coming up on her program. Now, we want to approach this with forbearance and great sensitivity, but this weekend on her program, she'll be addressing issues of feminism. And she'll give us a little idea of where she's going with that coming up into the 7 o'clock hour today. So stand by for that, an update on the federal Obamacare insurance subsidies and whether they will happen, whether they will not. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. We were treated, confronted would be a better word, with some news that's really kind of disturbing, quite frankly, especially in light of the downing of a commercial passenger jet just days ago over the country of Ukraine, the Malaysian Airlines jet that was just shot out of the sky, we believe, by Russian forces. Now this news comes to us, and this was posted from the Associated Press about 40 minutes ago. Its dateline is Algiers, Algeria. Authorities say a flight operated by Air Algier, carrying an estimated 110 passengers and a crew of six, has completely disappeared from the radar in a flight from Burkina Faso to Algiers. The official Algerian news agency said air navigation services lost track of the swift the Air Navigation Services lost track of the Swift airplane 50 minutes after it took off. It was flight AH-5017, AH-5017. It's been missing for hours, had been missing for hours before news was made public. So we don't, and again, this is a situation where the news media in the country of Algeria, it's controlled by the government itself. There's no free press, as it were, not like we know here in the United States. And nobody's able to discern exactly how many hours it was before the disappearance of this passenger jet with, looks like estimates are slightly over 120 people on board. Nobody knows exactly how many hours there were between the disappearance of this plane, just disappearing off the radar screen. You know, but think of how glibly and how casually we use that expression, off the radar. But here's a case where a commercial passenger jet carrying people from one destination to another, something we take very for granted here in the United States and elsewhere throughout the free world. A commercial passenger jet literally just disappears off the radar screen, as it were. But in very literal direct terms, it just disappears and nobody knows where it's at. And again, this is the second time a passenger aircraft has disappeared, or as the case of the Malaysian Airlines jet last week, just literally got shot out of the sky. That didn't disappear so much as it was just shot down by some very, very high-powered military weaponry. It is a very dangerous world out there, my friends. And it's something that should be cause for prayer, cause for concern. I'm not suggesting it warrants paranoia or living fearfully, but the stability, as incoherent and unstable and chaotic as American life and American society seems to be right now. And indeed, things are far more tumultuous, I would say, right now in the year 2014 than they were even 2, 3, 4 years ago, certainly more than they were 8 or 10 years ago. We've got some serious social and cultural upheaval in the United States, and that's brought to bear civil unrest in some parts of the country. We've got some serious problems. But relative to much of the rest of the world, if not most of it, we have a high level of consistency and stability. And this has somewhat of a trend, if this becomes a trend, let's put it that way, of passenger jets just going off the radar, just disappearing or being shot out of the sky. This could create some serious upheaval around the world that would touch home here in the United States. It is a cause for prayer, and it's something we're monitoring very carefully. Again, this was just breaking news, just released to the general public about 40, 45 minutes ago. An Air Algier passenger jet carrying an estimated 110 passengers and a crew of 6 just disappearing in a flight. We'll anxiously await more details and get them to you when we can. Still to come, where do you go if the federal insurance subsidy doesn't come through, the one that you or perhaps members of your family have been anticipating? We'll talk about that in just moments. It's 6:25. You're listening to Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. Radio Network. This is the Austin Hill in the Morning program. I'm here weekday morning 6 till 8, and I appreciate you being with us. Connecting Faith with Neil Stavem happens weekdays from noon till 1 on the Faith Radio Network. Yesterday on Connecting Faith, Neil's guest was Victor Boutros. Victor Boutros is a federal prosecutor specializing in human rights violations. He's co-authored a book about the locust effect, why the end of poverty requires the end of violence. They talked about how to bring about the end of both on yesterday's program. Let's listen in.
It's clear for most of the world's poor that the system is broken. But the question is this a solution that can only happen at upper levels of government, or what can we as individuals do? Here's Victor's response.
This is one of the most striking things that I have learned just in my own journey with God, learning about his passion for justice, is that that God actually really cares about justice. And he is, in the scriptures, the God of justice who calls us to walk humbly with him and to do justice for the poor and the oppressed. And he doesn't give us a calling or a mission that he doesn't also equip us to do. And it's this all hands on deck proposition where literally every listener who's listening right now is called by God to be involved in the work of justice. And everybody can be involved in at least one of three ways. The first is to actually go, is to go to the Jericho Road, to go to these places of need, which typically for us in America means stepping a little bit out of our comfort zone, going to places that we aren't naturally going to go to unless we're actively looking for them, looking for those people who are in need and beginning to work in your community to serve them and help them. So we can go. Some of us will go overseas. Some of us will go to Jericho Roads in our backyard. But the second thing that we can all do is we can also send. People who end up going just don't go magically. They go because they're mobilized by good teaching and by resources, and that's something that we can be a part of. And the third thing that we can all do is pray. And I think that sometimes sounds like just sort of a nice spiritual add-on, but C.S. Lewis really helped me see the power of this. He says, really, there's two ways in which God has given us power to be involved in his work of making his kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And one is the work of our hands, and the other is prayer. And we tend to think that the work of our hands is really the more powerful of the two, but C.S. Lewis says, no, it's actually not. The work of our hands is limited by our own strength. It's limited by our geography. It's limited by in scope, but prayer is not. It's not limited by our strength. It's not limited by our own geography. It's something that we can actively do. And it calls on us to know what's happening in the world, to educate ourselves, to connect with these hard places, to connect with the man lying on the side of the Jericho Road rather than passing by. And yet it's this great privilege to see how God will work these miracles of justice when we start showing up with small acts of obedience.
Author Victor Boutros, a guest with Neil Statham on the Connecting Faith program. You hear that weekdays, noon till 1 here on the Faith Radio Network. Today on Connecting Faith, Neil welcomes Brian Paulus of Life Action Ministries. They'll talk about what it means to bring about true spiritual reawakening here in the United States and around the world. That's on Connecting Faith coming up noon to 1 today here on the Faith Radio Network. It's 6:30. Thanks for listening. I'm Austin Hill. I'm your weekday morning, 6 till 8. When we continue in just moments, we'll talk about what a person is to do if they've been counting on the federal insurance subsidy that is supposed to be brought to bear by the federal Obamacare program. Does that continue? Does it not? There's a lot of uncertainty surrounding the initiative given two federal court rulings earlier this week. We'll talk to an economist and expert analyst when we come back. It's the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill in the morning. Good morning, 6:35. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill here weekday morning, 6 till 8, where we talk about things that truly do matter as we seek to connect faith to everyday life, as we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful. If you were a little confused a couple of days ago, you're not alone. I was a little bit confused when we saw news headlines, two conflicting headlines all in one day, two individual federal courts rendered very different rulings, very divergent rulings, as to the constitutionality of the federal Obamacare program. Now, in a grander sense, the Affordable Care Act, as it's officially known, that has been upheld by the United States Supreme Court, but the law and the initiative still face court challenges, and two federal courts rendered conflicting rulings as to the constitutionality of the ways in which insurance subsidies are to be distributed. Now, on the one hand, we saw a lot of people weighing in the media saying, well, this is great. We don't like Barack Obama and Obamacare, and this is terrible, and those judges did their job. Others, on the other hand, were saying, oh, these terrible judges, they're getting away of our president and this great program that he has. Let's strip away the politics and the opinions here for a moment and understand objectively there are some people, perhaps people in your family, in your community, maybe in your church, who are relying or are intending to rely upon these federal taxpayer-funded subsidies to acquire health insurance. And at the end of the day, the law requires most all of us to have some kind of insurance. So if you can't get the subsidy and you can't purchase insurance the way you are intending to, you might be found in violation of the law. Let's talk about real human beings and address this from the vantage point of a public policy issue and find our way forward. Joining us to talk about it, a gentleman who's an economist, graduate of Harvard Business School, former special advisor to President Ronald Reagan. He operates a consulting firm in Washington, D.C. today. He also is the chairman of the Pacific Research Institute, a nonprofit public policy group in California. His name is Clark Judge. He joins us on our guest line. Clark Judge, welcome to the Faith Radio Network, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Austin. Good to be with you.
Good to talk to you. Where do you begin in terms of trying to make sense of these two divergent and pretty contradictory federal court rulings 2 days ago?
Well, let me first tell you the issue involved, the legal issue, which is pretty simple. And then there are two groups that are affected by the decision and tell you who they are, actually three groups. The decision comes down to what did the law say. The IRS, the law itself says that the federal government, that the state governments, rather, can set up exchanges for selling health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do, that people in the state are eligible for a tax credit to make the insurance more affordable.
Right.
It does not say that the federal government, if the federal government sets up such an exchange, which it does if the state declines to set up the exchange, if the state says, no, this isn't for us.
Right.
Then the federal government sets up an exchange. But the law does not, in its language, say, okay, if the federal government sets up the exchange, citizens are eligible for a tax credit. Okay? Are you following me so far?
So far, so good. Sure.
Okay. Now, 36 states decided not to set up exchanges. They did it for a variety of reasons, but the principal ones have to do with the cost to the state and with the second part of this.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the people who might buy insurance benefit, right, from the tax credit. If there's an exchange sponsored by their state, but there are people who are hurt by the tax credit. That basically everybody in the state who would otherwise not want to buy health insurance, and more importantly, and probably more numerously, they're every employer in the state, because everybody then comes under the employer mandate, everybody who hires people, and everybody in the state comes under the employee mandate. They have to buy insurance.
Correct.
That's a number that's probably about 10 times as large as the people who actually benefit.
Okay.
So the court had to answer not that question, who benefits, who doesn't, but whether federal, if you were in a state with the federal exchange, whether you could get the credit. The reason it had to make this decision, the reason for this lawsuit, is that the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, ruled that despite the language of the law, which specifically said only that states with state exchanges had this credit available for the people in the state.
Yes.
Despite that, the Internal Revenue Service said, we'll also include we'll also give the credit. The IRS determines who gets the credit, right? They're the tax authority of the federal government. They said, no matter, we'll give the credit to people in states with the federal exchange. States that decided not to do this. And so, yes, there'll be people who benefit, but also employers will be charged. Employers will have to pay a certain amount per employee if they don't give the give them health insurance. You know, you've heard about that, $2,000 per employee. and anybody who doesn't buy health insurance is going to be penalized.
Okay.
They're going to have to pay a fine, too.
Yes.
And so that was what happened. The question was, what does the law say? The IRS, the law itself says only state exchanges, states with state exchanges, have this, come under this part of the law. The IRS said everybody else does too. And, so a group of people and organizations brought, a lawsuit and said, wait a minute, we're in states that don't have the exchange, we don't want to be subject to these penalties, the court agreed. Now,
that was one federal court ruling. And by the way, if you just joined us, Clark Judge, who is an economist and with the Pacific Research Institute, a nonprofit group in California, he's with us on the guest line helping us to make sense of these two conflicting federal court rulings over insurance subsidies with the Obamacare initiative. That was one court ruling, and then another federal court.
And then there
court
was another.
Yeah, and they are contradictory, right?
Court rulings before that. These were both appeals courts. There were district courts, which is to say trial court rulings, and they were, both of those were appealed. One was in what's called the Fourth Circuit, which I believe is Ohio and Michigan, and the other was the Federal Circuit, the D.C. Circuit, which is a special court that looks at regulatory issues in the federal government.
Okay.
Okay? And the appeal went in two different directions. The D.C. Circuit, in each, at least at the D.C. Circuit, I'm not sure at the Fourth Circuit, there was a typical three-judge panel. Now, that means that the courts can't, the appeals courts can't handle the volume of work required if they have all the judges hearing all the cases. There are just too many cases. So they break them up and typically set up panels of three judges to hear a case. And those judges will decide the case. And then if the party, someone of the, or the other party doesn't like it, they'll appeal. And then the courts, those courts will decide whether everybody's going to hear the case.
All right. Clark Judge, stand by. We need to take a quick break. We'll continue in just a moment and find out what comes after this, and what is the person who's relying on these insurance subsidies to do? That might be you. That might be somebody in your family, in your community. We'll find out coming up in moments. 6:45, this is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. On the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill, weekday morning, 6 till 8. Thank you for being here. So if you know somebody who is relying on or had intended to rely upon a federal insurance subsidy so as to be able to afford health care insurance maybe later this year or next year, that is called into question and up in the air given a couple of conflicting court rulings on the federal Obamacare initiative. Clark Judge is an economist and analyst. He's with us on the guest line giving us some insight here. Clark, we see that there's a couple of conflicting court rulings. One says, hey, the way this is set up with the various state and federally controlled insurance exchanges, it's not constitutional. Another court came in later in the day, on Tuesday, and said, apparently, no, it's okay the way it's set up. What do we do in the case of these two conflicting courts rulings, and what can we anticipate in terms of health insurance and subsidies and the distribution of these services?
Well, for probably about a year at least, nothing. Because this, as I said earlier, we're now at a certain level in the appeals process. There'll be an appeal within the court, within the D.C. Circuit, probably within the Fourth Circuit, too. That will take some months. Then there'll be an appeal to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court will almost certainly take these cases, but there's a chance that for example, if the D.C. Circuit, as many people think, decides the full circuit, not just this panel, decides that, yeah, the Fourth Circuit is right, then the two circuits will be in agreement, and the Supreme Court might not take the case. If the Supreme Court does take the case, we're still looking at sometime next year, maybe even late next year, before they actually hear and decide upon the case. So we've got a ways to go yet.
So as this is sort of playing out, shall we say, in courts, there's real people who have been told by their government that they will have this benefit, this help available to them, real people who need and want and very legitimately need health insurance coverage and eventually health care. Can we rely on this?
If the ruling stands, no. If the ruling stands, the subsidy will go away. That doesn't mean that people won't be able to buy insurance. They won't be able to buy the. They will be able to buy the insurance through the exchanges or, however, but it will be more expensive. How much more expensive? It depends on the state. One of the problems that we've seen with this program is that the insurance is coming in as quite a lot pricier than had been anticipated in the beginning. That means both that the subsidy is larger, and it also means that the programs that people might buy are just harder to whether or not there's a subsidy are going to be harder to afford.
Okay.
So you know, we've got a ways to go in this. One of the problems with the insurance that is available now under the law is that the law added in a lot of things that many people wouldn't want to buy in terms of coverage, but that Congress decided or the IRS decided were required by the law, and that pushed up the price.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you've heard all about how the insurance has become much more expensive in many states, not all states,
right,
but in many states under the law, and that has to do with the amount, the number of requirements and lack of basically one-size-fits-all policies.
Clark Judge, an analyst with the Pacific Research Institute, a nonprofit group in California, with some thoughts on the federal Obamacare insurance subsidies. And the future looks murky. Perhaps we all would do well to find other means of obtaining the coverage that we need for ourselves and our families. Clark, as always, thanks very much for joining us. We look forward to speaking again. It's 6:52. This is Austin Hill in the Morning. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. Our program continues momentarily. Good morning and welcome to the Faith Radio Network. Live the Promise with Susie Larson. That airs weekday afternoons 3 till 5 p.m. Central Time. It's now in a new two-hour format, Susie Larson is, which is great. Yesterday on her program, she welcomed Karen Rivadeneira to talk about finding one's daily bread in the middle of difficult seasons of life. Let's listen in.
Well, you know, we hate the thought of being desperate. But as I said at the beginning of the show, we're desperate whether we understand that we are or not. And I love what you wrote here. You said, when we aren't desperate, we're not looking. And when we aren't noticing God or how he provides, and then we miss a whole lot of holy ground. We miss a whole lot of what God is offering us through our needs for him. And I'm thinking of others like that, where they're in the trauma still of the disruption of their lives, where they're just, you know, exhausted, worn out, going, I can't see him anywhere because I'm so traumatized by what has just happened. What steps can they take to just start to notice God and see his provision?
No, that's a great question, because it is. I know this is so tricky to tell people when you are so afraid, because the last thing you want to do is offer pat things of, oh, it'll be better. You know, being desperate is good. And of course it is. But I would just suggest starting with those small things. What are the tiny ways that you notice God? And maybe it is, you know, keeping a gratitude journal. A lot of people do that. But maybe beyond that, do put your senses to the test, you know, sort of like I did in the woods that day. How do you see God? How do you feel God? How do you taste God? Where do you sense his presence? And being really, really intentional about that, just noticing God, because he is everywhere. He's at work everywhere. And even for things like small coincidences, you know, how about instead of just going, oh, that's funny, I can't believe that, that's random, maybe you look at it and go, hey, that was a gift from God that I happened to bump into that old friend at the Jewel, or the grocery store, you know, whatever it is. Start accrediting those things to God. Because he is there. He is at work in this world. And I think that's very, very helpful. So we don't start getting the sense that God is ignoring us completely. We don't ever understand why he doesn't rescue us. I mean, I love that example of your dad. That might actually give some great insight into what God is thinking.
You know, and he does give us good gifts, and every good gift comes from him. But we do miss it. We do miss it when we're in that trauma place, and I think it's just so good that he's so patient and he leads us. Well, you've shared a few stories of God's provision. Can you think of a few others? What are some of the ways that God just sort of kept you provided for along the way?
He did. Oh, definitely our family. There were some friends, too, and I'm thinking of one man that I remember. It was kind of in the early stages before we had really told people about how dire our situation was, and my husband came home and he said, I had lunch with so-and-so, and he goes, and I just told him where we were at. And I was actually angry at my husband because I thought, you told him? You know, how embarrassing. And I went through all this. And the next week we got a stack of grocery cards from that man. And it was so amazing because it was at a time where I didn't know where we were going to, you know, how we were going to buy food. You know, I would have had to go back on the credit card that was inching toward being maxed out, you know, and I think that that's part of what we have to do, you know, to realize it's okay. Everybody has some source of being broke in their life, you know, but we get so afraid and so embarrassed to tell people, hey, we're struggling with this, but people can't help us unless they know. So really being willing to tell people in a safe way to say, hey, you know what, we could use some help. Not necessarily coming out and saying, can you give me gift cards, but letting people know. Most people, especially in church communities, are very ready and willing to help if they only know.
You know, I think it's amazing, you know, when you tell that story at the benefit for homeless people. You were somebody who was a big giver, and then you had to go and be on the receiving end, and you received a roll. You received a bread after you're saying, give us this day our daily bread.
Uh-huh.
I think, you know, we are much better givers when we've humbly had to receive. And I just think we have so much more compassion for those who need what we have, you know. We don't want to be on that side of the equation, but it does make us better givers, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, that's the thing. You know, I'm always careful that, you know, when I talk about this, I understand that, you know, we never reached the level of poverty or that so many people do know. And yet, just being in that situation of knowing the fear, you know, of potentially losing a home, of not knowing, you know, of not being able to pay medical bills for kids, you know, of not being able to go to the dentist because you don't have money, just being in that totally breaks and opens your heart, I think, for the people suffering, you know, in our communities and around the world. And I am grateful for that because you're right. It's totally changed my perspective on giving and why we are called to do this.
From yesterday's episode of Live the Promise with Susie Larson, today on our program, she speaks with former prodigal child Andrew Palau, son of famed pastor Luis Palau. Live the Promise weekdays at 3 here on the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning. It is 7:04 and welcome to it. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Honored to be with you weekday morning, 6 till 8, as we seek to connect faith to life and vice versa, quite frankly. I'm trying my best to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful as you start your day. Coming up in just moments, a great friend to the Faith Radio Network and beloved host for our listeners, Kim Cotola, who hosts Cradle My Heart, a program you hear on Sunday evenings here on the Faith Radio Network. She'll join us momentarily to tell us what's coming up this weekend. She's going to take on the issue of feminism and its underpinnings with women's public policy, among other things. We'll talk about that coming up in just moments. Also, what happens when individuals like you, like me, when we want transparency, we want to get honest with ourselves and with others in the context of the church? Craig Gross is a pastor. He is an author. He's, I guess, in the minds of some sort of a, I want to use this term judiciously and carefully, kind of a provocateur, in as much as back 12 years ago, he really shook things up in the world and in our country anyway, with the publication of a website called Triple X Church. XXXChurch.com is the website. And through that outreach, that web-based endeavor, he sought to address the issue of pornography consumption among churchgoers. And I think our national conversation, at least the conversation in the Christian community around the free world anyway, has gone from, well, this doesn't really happen in the church all that much, why are we doing this, to, yeah, it's far more pervasive and commonplace than anybody wants to admit, but let's admit it, let's get honest with one another. Craig Rose, author of the book Open, he joins us coming up at about half an hour from now to talk about openness among Christians in our culture, in our world. So all of this and more just ahead. We're also following very carefully. The details are sketchy, but certainly a matter to commit to prayer, I suppose. A commercial jetliner in the country of Algeria, which is, of course, located in the continent of Africa. Commercial jetliner has just disappeared over the last few hours. We don't know exactly when it disappeared. News reports were just released by the government of Algeria as recently as 2.5 hours ago. But some 110 passengers and 6 crew members just disappearing out of sight. This is the second incident in less than a week of a commercial jetliner either dropping out of the sky or just going off the radar. It's a scary world. Keep praying. 7:07, this is Austin Hill in the Morning. Our guest, Kim Cotola, in moments. Good morning and welcome to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. On Sunday evenings, 8 p.m. Central Time, you're accustomed to hearing here on the Faith Radio Network a program called Cradle My Heart. It's hosted by a lady named Kim Cotola. It's a program committed to addressing the issues of what comes after an abortion, what sort of sufferings are endured by the mother, perhaps other extended family members and such. Kim Cotola joins us now on the guest line here on the Faith Radio Network to give us a sneak preview of this Sunday. Kim, welcome back. Good morning.
Hi, Austin. How are you today?
I'm well, thanks. Doing my best to sift through the day's news. I'm sorry, you were saying? Go ahead.
I was going
to
say, you are meeting your mandate. You are informing me and you are helping me and giving me hope. It's all good.
Well, you're very gracious and very kind. Listen, you tackled some fairly sensitive and, I want to even say, controversial issues on your program Sunday evenings here on the Faith Radio Network, and you do that with great tact and great skill, but you don't shrink from it. As I understand it, this Sunday evening you'll be addressing feminism and feminist underpinnings pertaining to abortion. Tell us where you're going with this.
Well, feminism has never been my primary issue, although it is part of my backstory. And I like what Pastor John Enzer had to say about the pro-life issue. He said, you know, abortion isn't just something that's happening in Washington where policy is being discussed. Of course, it's happening in our neighborhoods. And I think the same thing is true if we think about, you know, the feminist worldview. It's not something that's just being debated by women in New York somewhere. I don't know what picture we would have when you say this word feminism, or militant women on college campuses demanding rights. Feminism has become, I think, the default worldview of our country. In many ways, it's a good thing because, of course, I believe in equal opportunity for girls and women. Our daughters grew up playing sports and excelling in that area and, of course, you know, had pursued education to the master's level, and they're thriving in the work world, and that's great. I would never... And I realized that's progress. I mean, that wasn't so 100 years ago for women in our country.
We wouldn't want to go back, right.
Right. But some of the unintended consequences of the women who drove the feminist agenda, particularly in the 1960s, regarding sexual behavior. The unintended consequences, I think, are something that we're having to sort through as individuals in ways we never anticipated, and abortion is definitely one of those issues.
Kim Cotola, she is a host Sunday evenings here on the Faith Radio Network on our various affiliate radio stations. You'll hear her this Sunday evening as she addresses some of the feminist connections to female sexuality, yes, but the abortion issue in particular. Tell us further where you're headed with that. Was the feminist initiative or feminism as a governing philosophy something that brought abortion to the limelight here in the United States, would you say?
Well, people like Gloria Steinem and others before her realized, of course, that as long as women had to deal with the consequences of sexual behavior outside of marriage or in marriage, but as long as women became pregnant as a result of a sexual encounter, had that potential, they would never have equality with men because men are able to walk away from that sexual encounter. And so the remedy to put women on an equal footing with men was to eliminate this, you know, potential for pregnancy. So we had contraception, and then if that fails, of course, as it does, even the most effective methods have failure rates. So the fail-safe for contraception failure is abortion. And what interests me about that idea is that equality with men actually diminishes female dignity, right? Because sexually we are, in one way, miraculously superior to men in that we can create new life out of our bodies, something men can't do. So we took ourselves down to the level of men, in my view, by eliminating the procreating role that God has given women. And when I set out as a young woman, I wasn't intending to become a mother. That wasn't a goal for me. And so abortion, the pregnancy sort of shattered my dreams of future, and abortion presented itself as the easy answer. But pregnancy is what makes us mothers. And, abortion on demand may relieve us of our duties as mothers, but it can never free us from becoming one. And so we're going to talk with a guest who went full bore into the feminist movement as a result of having chosen abortion. And
all right. And I want to find out about that guest. Can you hold on for another segment?
Yes, we'll do.
All right. Stand by. Kim Cotola, your host Sunday evenings here on the Faith Radio Network, telling us some... offering some great insight, shall we say, about how feminism has impacted our culture, really throughout the course of my lifetime, perhaps yours as well. She'll address it with a guest coming up Sunday evening. We'll find out more in a moment. 7:14, it's the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. This is the Austin Hill in the Morning program on the Faith Radio Network. Kim Cotola is a host you hear Sunday evenings, 8 p.m. Central Time on the Faith Radio Network. She's on the guest line with me now as she has begun to address some of the issues of feminism, some of the issues that feminism has brought to bear in our culture, things that have become so commonplace that perhaps we don't even think about them a whole lot. And Kim, you were noting earlier how a feminist philosophy in our culture sort of brought this idea to bear that a woman, if she's to achieve quote-unquote equality with the man in the marketplace, she needs to be free to eliminate a pregnancy if and when she chooses to. It strikes me, and I know you're going to tell us about your guest on the program this weekend, I want to get to that, but before we do, it strikes me that some of the very elements of feminism that you're describing really get borne out in much more subtle ways, like, for example, the whole notion of girl power that's very popular with elementary and junior high and high school public school students, the notion that, you know, girls can be just as great as boys. And, I mean, gosh, I'm wondering, have we produced unintended consequences given that we've almost gone full circle such that girls oftentimes outperform boys academically and go on to college and become better educated than their male counterparts? That's where we're at right now. I mean, is that where this has led to, in your view, the feminist influences in our culture that you were alluding to earlier?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that one of the there's a lot of evidence out there that boys do suffer academically because of an imposition of a feminist model on education. That's not my expertise, but we could talk about that because there is evidence to support what you're talking about there, that boys have suffered from this. And I think, you know, that's one of the issues. Is equality really possible, or will someone always suffer if you're going to try to take a worldly system like that and say women and men are equal? Of course, what we know from God's Word is that we're meant to be, you know, complements to one another. There's complementarianism versus egalitarianism on this struggle in biblical manhood and womanhood. And it's a third way that Christ proposes for us, that each is to bow to Him. And as we do so, we draw closer to one another. That's a very different idea than the way that feminism would order the world. But
what you're describing there presupposes that men and women, boys and girls, they are distinct according to their gender. They're different, in other words. They're not equal. They are inherently, from the get-go, by design, unequal in the sense that they are different. Is that a fair assumption?
Exactly. And they have distinct roles to play.
Yeah.
And one role is not at the expense of the other. They complement one another. And our guest this Sunday is interesting because I think she represents what happened with so many women, that we didn't decide to take on a feminist philosophy. We chose abortion, and then we looked around and we said, who will accept me now? And, looks like that's a feminist point of view. I guess I'm pro-choice. And we attach to it, if you will. And Catherine Adair did that big time, ended up marching on Washington, ended up being very vocal about her feminism, and actually went to work at Planned Parenthood counseling other women to choose abortion.
Mm-hmm.
But she has left that and now become a 100% advocate of families and the cause for life. So her story, I think, is a unique perspective from one extreme, really, to the other.
It sounds like it. Sounds like one of those, to use a biblical metaphor, sort of a scales falling from one's eyes sort of experience.
Yes, I think so. And I think she also can give us unique insights into what happens at Planned Parenthood and what their ideology really is, what their approach to life really is, because they have a public persona as an organization that they like to put forward, but people who have worked there paint a very different picture of that particular organization, which, you know, it, after all, is the largest single provider of abortions in America. So it's not really a show about Planned Parenthood, but it can give us some insights into their methods and how they're setting the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Kim Cotola, host of Cradle My Heart, Sunday evenings, 8 p.m. Central Time, here on the Faith Radio Network. This is a part and parcel to the discussion she'll conduct coming up this Sunday evening here on the Faith Radio Network. So we hope you're with us at that time. Kim, real quick, before I let you go, what do you advise women, mothers, or even men and husbands and fathers who are concerned about some of the ways in which these philosophies, these ideologies, have maybe crept into their own household, their own way of thinking, their own family? Maybe parents are concerned about what their sons and daughters are hearing in the classroom or in the culture in which they live. What do you advise people to do in terms of maybe beginning to see things a bit more clearly and truly seeking out a biblical worldview on these issues?
It's a great question, and I get it from pastors. How do I possibly preach against women's rights, reproductive freedom, all of these rhetorical devices being used in the conversation? And the answer is, I believe, as simple and as complex as proclaiming the truth of the gospel, that, you know, Christ came for all. And there is nothing we can do as people to remedy the fact that we live in a fallen world. We have to follow God's way, and we have to know it. We have to know God's word. We have to stand upon it as our starting place. We cannot go on defense and allow someone to say, well, I have a right to have that abortion, because God's word says nobody has a right to do what's wrong. So we've got to lead and be proactively proclaiming truth.
As risky as that may be.
That's right.
Yeah. Kim Cotola, Cradle My Heart. You can find her at myfaithradio.com. She's here Sunday evenings, 8 p.m., and she'll be here again this Sunday. Kim, thanks so much for what you do. Thanks for joining us. We look forward to talking to you again, and we'll be listening this Sunday.
Thank you, Austin.
Good to be with you. By the way, speaking of the issues that Kim brings to bear on this issue of feminism in the church and really understanding the issues before us in a clear and succinct sort of way. I note today at Christianity Today's website, that's a, obviously I'm sure you're probably familiar with that, it's a magazine publication, but they're at ChristianityToday.com. Striking editorial that I'll tell you about a little bit later this hour, written, interestingly enough, by a woman who is an English professor. And this is noteworthy because this English professor, a lady who's a professor of English at Liberty University, she breaks down rhetorically, and even just in terms of the language that gets used, she breaks down the arguments, the debates, the comments that we are accustomed to hearing in our culture about quote-unquote birth control and what exactly should our government be mandating, what exactly should our government be providing coverage for when it comes to birth control. In fact, this female English professor, I'll tell you exactly who she is. I won't give away her name just yet, but this female English professor at a university in Virginia kind of breaks down the notion that, hey, birth control gets defined in different ways and depending on the context of the discussion. And so as a good student and professor of language, a good English professor should be doing, she says, listen, we can't have intelligible discussions about these things if we're not agreed about a common language. You know, if you're defining birth control one way and I'm defining it another, the dialogue is going to be just incoherent from the get-go. It's a very important part of discerning the world that we live in. I'll tell you about this piece that appears at ChristianityToday.com, and we'll post a link to it coming up later this morning. 7:24, you're listening to Austin Hill in the Morning. Thank you for being here. This is the Faith Radio Network. Our program continues momentarily. Don't go away. Good morning. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill, and we're glad you're with us. Craig Gross is an author, speaker, pastor, and in the minds of many, a revolutionary. He shot to prominence back in 2002, some 12 years ago, and he founded the website xxxchurch.com. That's xxxchurch.com. Set up that website as a response to the people he saw being hurt in the pornography industry and those who made their living in the porn industry as well. He joins us now to talk about open, what happens when you get real, get honest, and get accountable, his book. Craig Gross, welcome to the Faith Radio Network. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It sounds to me like you have actually shaken things up in the Christian community and perhaps even elsewhere. With this whole notion that somehow the church is a place where people do get real, get honest, and get accountable. How have people responded to you since the book came out?
Well, I think, you know, we started Triple X Church back in 2002, and I would honestly say the church wasn't ready at all for these conversations. But since then, it's gotten a lot easier. I think, you know, the popularity of stuff like Celebrate Recovery, just churches that have tackled topics like sex and pornography. I wouldn't say it's common in every church, but I noticed a shift around 2005 where churches were starting to warm up to this, where we were actually invited to these places on weekend services to talk to their whole congregation. So I think by the time this book came out open, the biggest shift for me is trying to get people to admit that, hey, the church is supposed to be like a hospital, not a country club. You know, I think we're all afraid of showing weakness, but I think it shows strength when we actually talk about our struggles, our temptations, the things that trip us up. I mean, we see Paul talk a lot about that through Scripture. You know, here's a guy who wrote half the New Testament. So yeah, not making it, you know, accountability a bad thing, but a good thing is an ongoing conversation we're trying to have over and over with people. You know, I think we're getting a little somewhere, maybe not there yet.
That's very interesting. Now, I suspect even among people listening in on our conversation right now, Craig, there's probably a presumption with many anyway that as you go about confronting the issue of pornography and pornography usage among people in the church, you're probably, the presumption is anyway, you're probably talking predominantly about men. I'm wondering how accurate that is in your estimation. Is pornography something that primarily attracts men as consumers, or is it something that women consume as well, and it's a problem for them as well?
Yeah, over, and this is shocking, I think, for me to learn years ago, and then obviously for people to hear these stats. I think we grew up thinking that. And back in the day when you had the adult-rated shops and it was really hard to get, in the Playboy magazines back in the day, I mean, that was a male audience. But now we're living in such a sex-crazed, I think, culture where women are interested more than ever. I'm not going to argue that they enjoy this as much. You know, as a stereotype, you think guys are much more visual.
Mm-hmm.
But women are drawn to this for a number of reasons. I think it's something like a third of the visitors to pornography websites are women. And when you get under 30, you know, that would be this next generation. I think it's closer than the 40%. And just to kind of put this in context, I was in Chicago, Illinois last weekend at what they call a love and sex expo, which is so far from anything loving. Friday was girls' night. Girls get in free. And mm-hmm. So obviously, I mean, it was they didn't have to spend the money like the guys. But record attendance out of 23 of these conventions for the amount of women that showed up on Friday. You know, that's a market that they're definitely going after is women. Because a lot of women kind of think, well, if my husband looks at this or my boyfriend looks at this, or this is what guys want and are expecting, I might as well just join in and, you know, support them instead of just be mad at them all the time. So there's a lot more interest from females.
Yeah, very interesting. Craig Gross is a pastor. He's author of the book Open, What Happens When You Get Real, Get Honest, and Get Accountable. He's on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network. So, Craig, what does happen when people start to get real, honest, and accountable with their attraction to, their consumption of pornography within the context of the church? This, I'm guessing, is something that could be fairly volatile if it's not handled correctly. What does happen?
So I think what happens is something great. And here's the thing. If you can talk about porn and sex with somebody, a loved one, a family member, your spouse, your parents, you can talk about anything else. Because these issues are so taboo and there's so much shame and guilt wrapped in around it because of the fact that it's done in secrecy. So once you get that open, I really feel, I had a friend say to me, he said, hey, Craig, once I've talked about that, nothing else is off limits. So that's a good thing, not to the whole public, but for a couple people in your life, that there's no limits on where you can kind of go. And just this idea of not be hiding and be free of that. And so I think when those walls come down, when you actually aren't living with so much of that shame and the guilt that come from hiding it, mm-hmm. and it's out in the open, and you realize that you're not alone, wow, somebody else has gone through this, or somebody else is going to actually ask me about this, and you live your life like that, I think everything starts to change. And real help happens when you actually invite people into the conversation. You know, I've got a guy, you know, big football fan, and we work with a lot of NFL players, and you know, training camp starts this week, and so you got guys that are in for a crazy 2 weeks. I got an email from a buddy that's been on this journey last year, you know, struggled a ton with this year. Last night he says, Craig, and his wife was attached to this email along with 6 other people,
yes,
I'm off the camp for 2 weeks. You guys know my struggles. You guys know where I've fallen. Here's my schedule. Here's where I'm at. I need every one of you to give me a call. Give me a text throughout the day. I will respond unless I am training during these times. But I wrote back to this guy, and I just said, man, I'm proud that you're not carrying around all this stuff, that you've invited others, and you're strong enough to ask for help.
And that's profound what you're describing. Tell you what, stand by, Craig. We'll continue in just a moment here. Let's talk about taking that first next step for others of us to get towards that level of accountability that you're describing. We'll do that in just a moment. Pastor Craig Gross, author of the book Open, What Happens When You Get Real, Get Honest, and Get Accountable. He's the founder of Triple X Church. He confronts the problem of pornography in the church. I'm Austin Hill. This is the Faith Radio Network. We continue in moments. Thanks for supporting the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill, here weekday morning 6 till 8. It's 7:43 Craig Gross is a pastor and really turned the Christian community upside down back several years ago with the publication of a website called Triple X Church, confronting the issue of pornography consumption among people in the church. His book, Open, What Happens When You Get Real, Get Honest, and Get Accountable, that's turning heads as well. He's with us on the guest line. Craig, what's the first step? We certainly want people to get a copy of the book and read it in detail, but what's the first step that you recommend for the individual who's listening to us and man or woman, they're saying, you know, I got to quit doing this. I know it's wrong, but I'm stuck. I can't tell anybody. I'm ashamed of it. What's that first step that you recommend?
I think that first step is finding, realizing, one, hey, you're in that place you're in probably because nobody else knows. And so finding that safe place. For instance, my wife, she reads the book. Wasn't that excited about the book because she's like, hey, this is for people that struggle with porn. Like, and I go, no, it's not. And so at 38 years old, a gal that, she's been a Christian for 20 years, she read the book. She said, hey, I'm going to send it to my friend Katie. And I said, okay. She says it to Katie. And then she said, so how do we set this thing up? And I talk about it all in the book. I just invite her in to this conversation. Mm-hmm. And so she said, hey, Katie, what do you think about meeting once a week and we could talk about our families, our marriage, our struggles? And it was just that. And I said, I bet I know this gal enough that she'll be so excited. And, everybody shares stuff on Facebook and we share, what we ate, but do we really dive in a little deeper? And I said, that's the stuff that people have to realize is not going to happen on its own. It's going to take somebody inviting somebody else into this and saying, okay, how are we going to do this now? And I talk about all the specifics in the book. I'll just tell you, my guys' group looks a lot different than, my wife's, how they do things because females are different. But it's just this idea of getting started would just be finding who are those people in your life that maybe are on the same journey. They're just down a little further than you are.
Is that to say that your book, Open, is not so much about confronting the temptation and the allure of pornography, even the problem of pornography addiction, so much as it is about being transparent with other people about whatever a person's struggle may be?
Yeah, my experience and it comes from the topics of, sexual sin and pornography, but I think just even the title of Open, what happens when you get honest, real, and accountable, you fill in the blank today with what it is you're struggling with. I've seen these principles work, like I said, for my wife who doesn't struggle in that area, but just realized after reading it, wow, I'm trying to do things on my own, and I'm pretty closed off to everybody. And what would happen if I reversed that with, somebody else and, besides just my husband? And I've seen her, some incredible things happen and a bond with somebody else, unlike you'll have with anybody else when you realize, man, we're here for the good, the bad, and the ugly. Mm-hmm. And, so I think, I think we live in a world that, once again, shares a lot of information, but I don't think we're sharing the right information with people. We're leaving it at a surface level where I'm trying to help you go a little deeper with a few people and see what happens.
Very interesting. Craig Gross, his book, Open, What Happens When You Get Real, Get Honest, and Get Accountable. That's what we're talking about here on the Faith Radio Network. I suggested earlier that this could be kind of a volatile process that people embark upon. Is it ever volatile? And maybe a different question is, what are the risks involved for a person who wants to live this kind of life of transparency and they take that first step?
With anything new, there's risk. That's why I think you got to be careful on who you invite into that. We're not talking about sharing your deepest, darkest secrets with the public, but I think we all need. And I feel like, especially in the church, I know so many pastors that have nobody because, well, if I tell that guy he's an elder and he could fire me, or if I tell that person they're in my congregation, like we forget that Jesus came for the sick, not the healthy. And I think we pretend too much to be way too healthy. We're not exempt from these same struggles or these same temptations.
Very interesting. Craig Gross, his book, Open, What Happens When You Get Real, Get Honest, and Get Accountable. We'll make sure to have a link on this from our blog page at myfaithradio.com. Craig, we love what you do. I appreciate your time today. Thanks very much. We'll look forward to talking again soon.
Yeah, thanks.
7:48. And by the way, would you like to win a copy of his book, Open? Well, call us right now, 877-933-2484. We'll get you entered into a drawing for a copy of Open from Craig Gross. 877-93-FAITH. That's our number. Call right now. It's 749. This is the Faith Radio Network. It's 7:51. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill here weekday morning 6 till 8 where we talk about things that really truly do matter to our lives and to our families as we seek to connect our faith to our everyday lives. And we appreciate you listening. We appreciate your support of Faith Radio as well. You can support us anytime. Listen to our guest interviews, to our programs anytime, 24/7, on demand, vis-a-vis our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. We have been following over the course of the morning, and this news broke, by the way, just, oh gosh, about 20 minutes before we launched, just before 6 a.m. Central Time. But news of a commercial jetliner, Air Algier is the airline, flight 5017, that the aircraft just disappeared, or so we were told earlier. And we don't know exactly when the aircraft went off the radar, as it were. But now we're getting some details coming in. While Air Algier flight 5017 just went off the radar and disappeared for a period of time, we are now told, and this comes to us, I'm looking at a report here from the London Times, the disappeared Air Algier flight apparently has crashed near the country of Niger after flying through violent storms. So Algerian television is now confirming the plane went down because of bad weather. Very disturbing news and unsettling. I mean, a plane crash is bad enough. We saw, of course, just about a week ago, a commercial jetliner from Malaysia Airlines get shot out of the sky by some Russian separatist groups, as you'll recall, as it was flying some 30,000 feet up in the air over the country of Ukraine. Exactly whose airspace that was there in Ukraine, nobody knows because there's a geopolitical conflict there. But it's a very dangerous world. And the fate of the 116 on board is not good. It is presumed that they are all deceased, unfortunately. 110 passengers and 6 flight crew, we are told. But again, this is something that's just been puzzling all morning long, ever since this news first broke, certainly before 6 a.m. Central Time. Now this latest news out of London, Air Algier flight 5017 apparently crashed, so authorities believe, because of bad weather. It's a dangerous world, and it warrants our prayers. Here's some good news. This is this is the kind of thing that will just put a smile on your face, I hope. It comes to us from the FM region, the Fargo-Moorhead area. And just a little backstory, if you're perhaps a little caught off guard, a little surprised by why I think this kind of news is so cool, please understand, I have for almost 4 years now in total, and for almost 2 years on the Faith Radio Network, I've been hosting a weekend talk show. It's called Austin Hill's Big World of Small Business. And perhaps you've heard my weekend program before. It's quite different from what we do here on our morning show, but it's where we talk about entrepreneurship and business ownership and making a living even if one cannot find a job. We talk about labor and issues of the economy and try to see it all through the lenses of biblical truth and our Christian faith. I'm just crazy enough, and I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek. It's not crazy, but part of my mission in life is to communicate the truths that the Scriptures have available to us on issues of economics and business and work. One can read the Bible through, you know, Genesis to Revelation several times and still not get the profound truth that is ours in the Scriptures when it comes to issues of economics and business. That is, if we're not looking for it. So that said, anyway, we talk about those kinds of issues, and there's a very practical and pragmatic component of Austin Hill's Big World of Small Business, how to make a little extra money on the side, how to start a business on the side if you have a full-time job, how to put together a resume. And we talk about these practical kinds of things that I believe need to be discussed in the context of the church as well. But that said, I kind of see the world, hopefully through the lenses of Christian faith, yes, but I always kind of look at the economic implications of things. And so with that in mind, just kind of knowing what my passion, where I'm at with these kinds of things, I was really impressed with this story that comes to us from Fargo. Let me read to you just a little bit of this. This is just fun. In 1947, you know it's going to be an interesting news story when the opening line is in 1946, right? In 1946, Harry Truman was president of the United States. Ted Williams was the American League's most valuable player. And a man named Goodwin Huff was a college kid in need of a haircut. A native of Fargo attending Concordia College at the time, Huff heard that his friend's dad had a barbershop in the Graver Building in downtown Fargo, so he figured, hey, why not go there to get a trim? Well, that haircut turned into a ritual, one that's been performed every 3 weeks or so without fail at the same barbershop for 68 years. Hoff's only lapse in going to the same barbershop, God bless this man, his only lapse in going to the same barbershop every 3 weeks or so was the 2 years that he served in the U.S. Army in the Korean War. And he says, I didn't have any choice about, where I got my haircut or who did it back then, so I just took the haircut the Army gave me. But that said, 87-year-old gentleman Goodwin Huff, been going to the same barbershop, the Graver Barbershop in downtown Fargo, as I said, every three and a half weeks or so since 1946, back when he was a student at Concordia College. The Graver Barbershop, still going strong, apparently. And I just want to point out Mr. Hoff's devotion and, I guess, commitment to the local small business that is owned and operated there in the fine community of Fargo. And I would just encourage us all, using Mr. Hoff's example, I would just encourage us all to try to maybe aspire to be so aware of the local small business owners in our community. I mean, our economy is reliant on the success of these individuals. We live in a culture that kind of wants to say that anybody who owns a business is greedy and selfish and self-serving. That is not the case. To make a business work successfully, you have to start by focusing on other people. You have to create a product or a service that other people need. You have to care about their needs, their wants, their desires. You have to solve problems for them to be a successful small business owner. And oftentimes, unfortunately, in the Christian community, we really don't pay a whole lot of attention to the local small business owner until we need something. Yes, we might, when we're hungry, we go to the local restaurant. We need to buy groceries. We go to the local store, whatever it is. But beyond that, we may not think a whole lot at all about the local small business owner until it's time to maybe go ask them for a donation. I mean, think about it. If, the budget is tight and we need a little extra donation to make sure the kids get to summer camp or to the church retreat or what have you, well, we hit up the small business owner for a little charitable contribution, right? Let's think in terms of sustaining our local businesses. Let's even begin to ask the question, raise the concern, how are the local business owners and operators in our community doing? There's a ministry involved. I really do believe that. Thanks to Mr. Hoff for the great example at the barbershop in Fargo, North Dakota. I'm Austin Hill. See you tomorrow morning at 6. Have a great day and keep it on the Faith Radio Network. Podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. For more information about this, you can visit Austin Hill in the Morning, our program page, on myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com.